Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Words matter. That is one story in the global economy today. Also, here are two words that still matter 10 years on. Lehman Brothers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, the 10th day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a little corporate compare and contrast. The companies in question are Apple, Volvo and its Chinese parent company, and the Ford Motor Company. We've only got a half an hour to do the program today, so I'm going to give you the answer to the obvious question, which is, Kai, what are you talking about? So look, here's the thing. All three of those companies make things. And all three of them, directly or indirectly, have been the target of trade policies threatened by the United States. President Trump said on Twitter this weekend that it'll be too bad if iPhones cost more if he imposes tariffs on Chinese imports, iPhones, of course, being made in China. And he's threatened automobile tariffs more times than you can count, which gets us to this. Volvo, which does make a couple of models in China, has canceled a planned initial public offering, citing those tariff clouds. And Ford, which makes a version of its Focus in China, reiterated it's no longer going to export its Chinese-made cars to the United States because, again, tariffs. So as companies make multi-billion dollar decisions based on words and threats from Washington, now Marketplace's Scott Tong elaborates on the global auto supply chain.
Ford used to make its Focus in Michigan. Now it's built in China, where most of the buyers are. Ford's plan was to export a small amount back to the States until the president imposed 25% tariffs on Chinese-made cars. China auto analyst Michael Dunn heads the firm ZozoGo.
Those folks will be subject to duties of 25%, which would make them price uncompetitive. So Ford has said, nope, let's drop the plans.
The president said this weekend that Ford would bring jobs back. But Ford countered, nope, they're staying in China, as are the Focuses. Separately, Volvo, in its stock IPO cancellation, cited tariffs against its cars made in China and elsewhere. The stock prices of many car makers may fall even more, says Syracuse economist Mary Lovely.
There is a question as to whether or not the market has built this into prices, and I would argue that they probably haven't.
She expects more tariffs against Mexico and Europe, followed by counter tariffs. She says a trade war would raise prices so much that some vehicles would have to come off the market.
$1,500 would be the minimum, up to over $4,000, depending on the model. That's a lot of money, and it's clearly going to influence not only which vehicle models people get to see, but the nature of competition.
And because the China market is the world's biggest for new cars, she fears new innovative cars there could be walled off from us. In fact, analyst Michael Dunn says the new business model may be to require one plant per car in Europe, Asia, and North America to evade tariffs.
It'd be much more efficient to have one plant and ship product from that plant globally, but that may not go. You may have to have a plant in each market, and that means being a lot less efficient.
Costs will go up, he says. And so will prices. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
CBS, where until yesterday Les Moonves was the chairman and CEO, says it's taking $20 million from Moonves' severance package and donating it to one or more organizations that support the Me Too movement and equality for women in the workplace. And while there is no word on which organizations might get that money, Marketplace's Mariel Segarra does have this look at what might be in store for those that do.
Let's go back 4 years ago, summer 2014. A challenge was making its way around the internet. You may remember, people were dumping buckets of ice water on their heads to raise money for the ALS Association. Bill Gates did it, Mark Zuckerberg, and millions of other people. The money rolled in, $1 million, then two, then five.
And then it was $10 million a day for several days, and eventually it ended up being $115 million.
Brian Frederick at the ALS Association.
It certainly was a unique situation and, a blessing, but a challenge.
The organization was operating on a $20 million budget and didn't have the staff or the structure to immediately deal with that kind of money. A huge donation like the one CBS is doling out can be a game changer for a nonprofit. It's also a big responsibility. Amir Pasek, who teaches philanthropy at Indiana University, says most nonprofits have tiny budgets and staffs of fewer than five people.
It would be very difficult for an organization like that to figure out how to absorb $20 million if it was plopped right down in front of them.
You sort of need to have the infrastructure in place before you can receive major gifts.
Melanie Yulee at the consulting firm Philanthropy Expert says nonprofits need finance and compliance committees to monitor the spending of that kind of money. The ALS Association worked with charity watchdogs to get advice on how to spend its Ice Bucket Challenge money. CBS hasn't said where the $20 million is going, but it could be spread among several groups that advocate for women. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was firmly undecided. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are today 9 years and 359 days past the collapse of Lehman Brothers, maybe the singular event of the financial crisis. Lehman went under in the early morning hours of September the 15th, 2008. That is 10 years ago this coming Saturday, which makes this week Lehman Week. We've been spending a lot of time and energy this year on the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis, what it did, and in a way, what it's still doing to this economy. And this past spring, I sat down with the three people whose job it was to stop things from completely collapsing. Former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, also former Treasury Secretaries Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner. We're going to play a little slice of that interview again, picking it up chronologically with Bear Stearns having been bailed out and Lehman about to go under. You'll hear my question and then Tim Geithner giving the first answer. The number one question I get, and I'm sure you three get as well, when I go out and do things, we actually asked our listeners for what they want to ask you three. Number one is, why didn't anybody go to jail, which we'll get to in a minute. But number two is, why did you let Lehman Brothers fail?
Lehman was terribly weak, even relative to the other weaker institutions in this context. The world was terrifically fragile, very hard to find someone strong enough in that moment of peril that was going to be capable of taking on the vast bulk of that risk, like J.P. Morgan did in the Bear Stearns context. And the tools we had, the Fed was given, by Congress to deal with these things, were very limited and really were not effective and practical and valuable in preventing the failure of a weak, failing investment bank. The important thing about Bear in this context is, in many ways, people looked at what we were able to do that weekend, and many people found it reassuring. I think we found
during
it,
Bear, yeah, totally.
I think we found it the opposite because we knew that our ability to help prevent that devastating failure was totally dependent on there being someone large enough and strong enough to could absorb them, and we could help induce that to happen. But our tools were more limited than many people thought in that context. And going back and coming into Lehman weekend, we were left with those same tools.
Okay,
no better options.
But that's kind of my point, right? Because you did Bear, and it worked because of all the factors, right? There was a buyer. There were guaranteeable assets. The Fed could actually have collateral to lend against. I wonder if – well – did you set yourselves up to fail with Lehman because Bear Stearns worked out in theory so well?
Yeah, well, the point I tried to make early on, which I think is just the opposite, okay? I think that if we had had Bear Stearns go down, we would have had shortly thereafter, Lehman go down.
Right.
After the Bear rescue, Ben and I went and talked with Barney Frank at the House Financial Services Committee. We went up there and we said, we learned something, Barney. We don't have the emergency powers in our regulatory system to dealing with a failing non-bank.
Yep.
And when an investment bank starts to go, in the middle of a run, it disintegrates very quickly if you don't have the emergency power to guarantee or to put in capital. And so we need some kind of emergency resolution authority.
So, with Bear Stearns, I very well remember the conversation. I was on my cell phone getting out to the car in the morning, and Tim and Hank were on the phone, and we were saying, well, here's how we could do it. Should we do it or not? What are the pros? What are the cons?
Wow.
And we decided, okay, it's a go. We're going to do it. So we agreed to do it. We never had that conversation with Lehman because we never had a viable option. There were three ways in which we helped save firms. One was to have a buyer, and we thought we had a buyer, but we had both Bank of America and Barclays. Both of those failed. Second way was to inject capital, which is what we did after the TARP. But TARP didn't come until October, which was, of course, after Lehman. And the third way was temporary loans. But there you've got to have a company which is fundamentally viable and just short liquidity.
Right.
And Lehman was not viable, so that strategy didn't work. So we didn't really have – it wasn't a choice. We didn't have tools to prevent the failure.
And what Barney said to Ben and to me when we went up to see him, he said, we can't get you the emergency loan authority unless you come to Congress and scream and yell and say, if we don't get it, Lehman's going to fail and we're going to have a disaster. Maybe even then we can't. And of course, if we did that, Lehman would have gone down the next day.
Do you think it took Lehman to get you guys TARP? Do you think that is true?
Well, that's an oversimplification, but I will say this about Lehman Weekend. To put it in perspective, we had three institutions going down at the same time. We had Lehman, AIG, and we had Merrill Lynch. Okay. Now, it turns out we had one buyer. So we're unhappy that we're having trouble getting B of A to buy Lehman. But I tell you, if B of A had bought Lehman, then they wouldn't have bought Merrill Lynch.
Right.
And there would have been a bigger failure and it would have been worse. One thing the Lehman shock did was energize the system politically. That was what it ended up taking for us to get these emergency authorities to let us to recapitalize the whole financial system and avoid a catastrophe. So as bad as Lehman was, and it was terrible, this was not the worst alternative. We avoided worse alternatives.
I think I'm quoting you. When politics and the markets go head to head, the markets win. Oh my
God! I think we all believe it. I use that quote in the book, but we all knew it, and we were watching it, so we weren't trying to convince ourselves. But the other thing, which we've all said, is it takes a crisis to get Congress to act.
Sharp-eared listeners, and there were many of you when this aired originally back in March, will have noticed that I never did get back to the actual first question I was talking about, why nobody went to jail. A, yes, I know, thank you, I've been spoken to about that. B, we're working on that story. And C, you can hear the entire interview with Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, and Tim Geithner in a special podcast that we put in the Marketplace feed, or you can get it at marketplace.org. If you look at 2018 through the lens of organized labor, it's been most prominently the year of the teacher. Teachers in Arizona and Colorado, West Virginia, and Oklahoma have made headlines asking for better pay and better funding. Last year, a particular teacher in Tulsa, Oklahoma, had had enough, and she is today's installment of our series, My Economy, How Things Feel in People's Everyday, Away from the Economic Headlines.
My name is Teresa Danks, and I am... was a third grade teacher in the state of Oklahoma, and I'm also known as the panhandling teacher. I just told my husband, I said, I'm just so tired of begging. And he jokingly said to me, he said, well, I guess if it gets any worse, you can just make a sign and go to the streets like the panhandlers do. And I said, you know what? I think that would make a very good picture for social media. I said, that is exactly what we're doing. We are begging. So I had him take me over to a dollar store. I bought the poster board, got the markers, and I wrote, teacher needs supplies, anything helps. I was completely caught off guard when people started rolling down their window, not only handing me cash, but thanking me for being a teacher. I had a young lady say to me, a teacher like you is the reason I'm alive today. Like 24 hours later, just everything started blowing up. And so we set up an account and we started the nonprofit Begging for Education. We collected around $40,000 to give back to teachers in the state of Oklahoma last year. After the walkout, come the end of the school year, they were asking us to sign our contracts without even knowing exactly what it was going to be. And I don't know, it's just me. I just said, you know what, I'm not going to be bullied into signing a contract. I started doing online teaching, and I'm actually teaching English to children in China. I was able to replace my income in just a matter of a couple of months and actually make more money doing this than I did putting in about 55 to 60 hours a week teaching in the classroom. I get to do what I love, which is teach. I don't have to deal with any of the political red tape and all the other garbage that's going on with public education. And I don't have all the anxiety and the stress.
We can only tell these stories if you tell them to us. Marketplace.org is where you can do that. Coming up,
we had accountants, we had forensic accountants, we had financial consultants, we had investment bankers.
Consider that an incomplete list of what you'll need after you crash the economy. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street at the close did not look much different from Wall Street at the open today. Dow Industrials down 0.2%, 59 points, ended at 25,857, did the blue chips. S&P 500 inched up about 0.1%, 5 points, 2877. The NASDAQ added 0.25%, 21 points, 79.24. Investors weighed in on the CBS news. Les Moonves' departure, shares of CBS dialed back 1.5%. Traders were also keeping an eye on Hurricane Florence. Shares of Allstate Insurance fell more than 2% today. Different story for home improvement stores, of course, because that's the way hurricanes go. Shares of Lowe's gained 2.5%. Home Depot about 0.2% to the good. In tech news, Snap lost Chief Strategy Officer Imran Khan. Shares vanished nearly 2% today. Bonds inched up. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.93%. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the past year for helping keep public service journalism strong. We appreciate your support. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a whiff of anachronism in this next story, given that most of us have phones in our pockets that can tell us what time it is at a mere glance. But ham radio hobbyists and schools and hospitals and businesses and others who need perfect time signals are a bit up in arms. The Trump administration wants to shut down two of the three radio stations that broadcast those perfect time signals from the nation's atomic master clock, WWV in Colorado, which happens to be the world's longest continuously broadcasting radio station, and WWVH out of Hawaii, which extends that signal across the Pacific. Marketplace's Renata Sago has that story.
Michael Welch will tell you in a second. Perfect time means everything to him.
It probably means more to me than it does most people.
Perfect time means having your clocks and watches synchronized with the official master clock of the United States. That helped Welch and his team launch Apollo missions into space 50 years ago. Today, the 79-year-old uses perfect time to keep track of space launches and meetings.
I just have to have it that way.
And others need it that way, too, like meteorologists, utility companies, medical institutions, and broadcasters. Many of them rely on radio stations that broadcast perfect time with this gentle voice.
At the tone, 20 hours, 55 minutes, coordinated universal time.
The Trump administration has proposed cutting nearly $27 million from the budget of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which runs the radio stations. The administration says newer technology like GPS has wiped out the need for two of the stations that broadcast perfect time. Alan McCormick's company, La Crosse Technology, sells millions of devices that rely on radio time signals, wall clocks, watches, and so on. He says if the station his products rely on were to be eliminated too,
boy, we would have millions of unhappy customers. I mean, our call center would light up.
Because those clocks would go haywire. McCormick says old-fashioned radio signals are often better than GPS because the signal's stronger and the cost is lower. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
The actual line about how people go bankrupt, sometimes bastardized as slowly and then all at once, is properly from Hemingway in The Sun Also Rises, and it goes gradually and then suddenly. That was certainly true about Lehman Brothers 10 years ago this week, but modern corporations and finances being what they are, resolving that bankruptcy, liquidating a beast as big and as complicated as Lehman was, well, that's a long slog. So long, in fact, that Lehman actually still exists today, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
The great unwinding of Lehman Brothers kicked off in a Manhattan courtroom on a Friday afternoon, less than a week after the firm first filed for bankruptcy.
It's probably the single most dramatic bankruptcy hearing in history. It sounds like an exaggeration, but it's not.
Judge James Peck presided. He's now with the law firm Morrison & Foerster. At question was whether to allow the sale of Lehman's headquarters and its core business, its broker-dealer, to Barclays. This is the part of the business that traded stocks, provided advice on mergers, helped companies go public.
There was the sense that if this sale didn't go through, what was already horrible would just get much worse.
The sale would provide some market stability. It'd create continuity for customers and save some 10,000 Lehman jobs. But the deal had just been proposed a few days earlier.
The question was whether something this massive and complicated could be approved on such short notice.
The hearing stretched over 7 hours, no food breaks, until finally, after midnight, the judge approved the sale.
Believe it or not, people stood up and applauded.
That dramatic hearing was just the start. At the time of its collapse, Lehman was the country's fourth largest investment bank. Bankrupt, yes, but it still had more than $600 billion in assets and operations all over the world. And the people who understood what those assets were and how the firm's systems worked, those employees were mostly gone. Plus, Lehman's failure triggered roughly 80 different bankruptcy proceedings from its subsidiaries and a sort of feeding frenzy as each tried to gobble up as many assets as it could.
The claims were all very complicated, and there was no ultimate Supreme Court of Lehman to decide right and wrong.
The U.S. business split into two separate bankruptcies. The holding company, Lehman's parent company, that was one. Creditors filed more than $1 trillion in claims against it. The other was the broker-dealer, what was left after the sale to Barclays. Chris Kiplock is a lawyer with Hughes Hubbard and Reed. He's been working on the broker-dealer bankruptcy for a decade. His first task?
Quite simple questions. How many customers were there? What were they owed? Where were the assets? How would we return them?
Lehman's customers ranged from giant hedge funds to a grandparent investing for college. And then there were the creditors, figuring out who they were, if their claims were valid, and in what order they had to be paid. At its peak, the wind down of just the broker-dealer involved some 700 people.
We had accountants. We had forensic accountants. We had financial consultants. We had investment bankers. And obviously a large team of lawyers sorting through the wind down.
The estate also had to chase down and collect what Lehman was owed when it failed. It had to oversee and eventually sell the securities and other assets Lehman owned.
We had a majority stake in a prison company that we had to sell. Everything from a shipping company to derivatives that we'd have to talk to a PhD economist to explain to us why they're even worth anything.
Now, 10 years later, the holding company and the broker-dealer, they're both finally nearing the end of the wind down. Customers got all their money back. The estates have worked through the vast majority of creditor claims. But some people are still waiting, hoping to get money out of Lehman's estate. One of the last big claims outstanding against the broker-dealer involves some 350 former Lehman employees who bought into a deferred compensation plan in the 1980s. They invested some of their paychecks for retirement. Ed McGuinn was one of them.
This was in lieu of a pension because Lehman had a very penurious pension.
Penurious, by the way, adjective meaning?
Cheap.
McGuinn's 67 now. He left Lehman in the early 90s, long before the firm's implosion. By 2008, the $400,000 he'd put in this deferred compensation plan was worth about $1.2 million. He and some 350 others are still hoping to collect. They're appealing a court decision that puts their claim behind a long list of other creditors. Their lawyer says the case could take another few years to resolve. And Lehman remains the biggest bankruptcy in history. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Kevin Hassett, the chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, says, yeah, I don't know what's going on with the president's Twitter feed either. This morning, the president said on Twitter, and here I quote, the GDP rate, 4.2%, is higher than the unemployment rate, 3.9%, for the first time in over 100 years, exclamation point. End quote, and not correct. That's actually happened 22 times in the past 100 years. So Hassett was asked about it at a White House briefing today, said he, you'd have to talk to the president about where that number came from, but the correct number is 10 years. And then later, he said, I'm not the chairman of the Council of Twitter Advisors. And we are out of here. Dow Industrials off 0.2% today, 59 points. S&P 500 was up about 0.1%, 5 points. NASDAQ added 0.25%, 21 points, 79 and 24. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Kate Lanesh is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.